a plan on how to proceed, taking these things into account?
It is weakened, said Mr. Fitz. We have sorceress brassards that provide some protection against such things as Zavatish lackish tacks. We will don them at a suitable proximity.
Oh, the agent's brassard, exclaimed Philtak.
He reached inside his cloak and drew forth a broad silk armband, some 5 fingers wide, embroidered with a symbol of great familiarity to Sir Hereward and Mr. Fitz, that of the Council of the Treaty for the Safety of the World. Though the symbol did not glow as it should from the sorcerous thread used to sew it, it was unquestionably genuine and merely quiescent. Sir Hereward stopped, boots crushing ice emphatically.
Where did you get that?
His face was set and hard, his eyes narrowed, his body tense to take action. The brassards were supposed to fall into dust if they left their owner's possession for more than a night and a day, and were carefully handed down from one agent to the next, often as a deathbed ritual. Once again, Mr. Fitz touched Hereward's shoulder, restraining the knight from sudden lethal action.
It is also a family heirloom, said Philtak, oblivious to his danger. With the sword, though the old tales say it should light up, brighter than a lantern.
It will, said Mr. Fitz. May I hold it a moment?
Philtak passed the brassard to Mr. Fitz, who tasted the silk with his tongue. A ripple of light passed through the silken threads, fading as the puppet handed it back.
Curious, said Mr. Fitz. It is very old, not some recent find, Hereward. Philtak must indeed be a descendant of some long-lost agent. The brassard will answer to the invocation in due course. Come, we must hurry.
They marched on, the weather around them returning to its more natural state, the air warming and the snow melting. There was still a clot of darkness ahead, but clearly Zava was saving its strength, for the black cloud no longer stretched across the horizon, but was concentrated in an area of a few hundred yards about the godlet. A few times they caught sight of Zava itself, for they were descending a broad slope toward the smallest sea, and there were several sections where it was quite steep, and the height extended their view, cloud notwithstanding. But always the snow swirled and closed about the godlet, so they saw little, beyond that it was still using 3 sets of legs in an ungainly motion that provided slightly slower locomotion than the pursuers could manage on their own better twinned pairs of legs.
The Cimmerilla have thrown down the bridges, remarked Mr. Fitz, who could see more clearly through the snowy cloud.
The smallest sea was little more than a lake, dotted with many islands, which were connected by a multitude of bridges of many different makes and load capacities, forming a veritable maze of water crossings that usually required a local and not inexpensive guide to navigate, particularly if requiring bridges that might support wagons or draft animals.
"We will catch it on the shore, then," said Sir Hereward. "What do you intend? Don the brassards and close?
We too distract Zava as best we may while Philtak takes off Eudonia's head with the God-taker?"
He spoke lightly, but with a clear knowledge that the godlet was almost certainly still potent enough to draw out the life essence of any or all would-be distractors, regardless of the protection offered by the brassards. The only question would be if the godlet could do it quickly enough to avoid the banishing stroke from Philtak's sword.
"I fear the lack of a bridge does not halt the godlet," replied Mr. Fitz, blue eyes bright. "It is making its own of ice. Come, we must be on the ice it makes before it melts again."
Sir Hereward broke into a run, the basket bobbing up and down on his back. Philtak ran at his side, exhibiting none of the puffing and blowing he had done before when they had met him earlier that day, adding credence to his story about how brandishing the sword slowed all around him, including the air. There was a layer of ice on the muddy shore, which cracked under their boot heels, but the broad swathe that led out across the water looked considerably thicker, much to Sir Hereward's relief. He paused by the shore to drop the basket before testing the ice with his sword. It held against several blows, and he stepped out upon it, causing no cracks or disturbing movement. Despite the thick ice underfoot, it was not particularly cold.
"Zava expends much of its strength upon the ice bridge," said Mr. Fitz, bending down to inspect the newly frozen surface of the lake. "That is good. It is only 50 or 60 yards ahead of us now. Come, don the brassards. We shall do as you suggest, Hereward, the two of us distracting it for Philtak to make the banishing blow. Philtak, you must strike for the neck and take the head off with a single blow. Can you do that?"
Philtak licked his lips nervously, then nodded. He hesitated further for a moment, then drew the lorgnette out of his cuirass and wrapped the cord around his head to keep the lenses balanced on his nose.
"Not the best eyes," he said, "but I can do what must be done. I am Philtak the God-taker."
"After this, he will be indeed," muttered Sir Hereward, who was pulling his brassard over the sleeve of his buff coat, not an easy operation with fingers still numb from cold. He thought, but did not say aloud, "If you live."
"Remember to drop the sword as soon as the stroke is through," instructed Mr. Fitz. "Now, slide the brassard up your arm, and we will do the declaration as we hurry along. Repeat what Sir Hereward and I say. Are you ready?"
"Yes, I am ready."
Knight and puppet spoke together, with Philtak a few moments behind. The symbol on their brassards shone more brightly with every word, the God-taker's no less brilliant for all its antiquity.
"In the name of the Council of the Treaty for the Safety of the World, acting under the authority granted by the three empires, the seven kingdoms, the Palatine Regency, the Jessa Republic, and the 40 lesser realms, we declare ourselves agents of the Council. We identify the godlet manifested on the ice ahead as Zavatish Lakishtax, a listed entity under the treaty. Consequently, the said godlet and all those who assisted are deemed to be enemies of the world, and the Council authorizes us to pursue any and all actions necessary to banish, repel, or exterminate the said godlet."
When they finished the declaration, Philtak had a broad smile upon his face. They had been walking while they spoke, but now Mr. Fitz urged them to move more quickly.
"Faster! The godlet sprints for an island, and the fools have only thrown down the closer bridges."
The puppet ran ahead, bending almost double and using his hands as well as his feet, his spindly limbs making him all too reminiscent of some injured spider that had lost half its legs. Sir Hereward galloped after him, both pistols drawn, with Philtak close behind, who had not yet drawn his sword. As they ran, the snow cloud ahead dissipated, pulling apart to become mere streaks across the sky. They saw Zava clearly, 100 yards short of the closest island. But it was not moving straight for the shore. Two of its legs were trying to take it back the way it had come, and the others were straining to go forwards, resulting in a crab-wise sprawling motion.
"Eudonia has risen within it," cried Mr. Fitz. "Quickly now."
He matched action to his words, drawing his triangular blade to send it whirring through the air as fast as a crossbow bolt. It struck one of the added-on legs above the knee, inflicting a terrible wound, but not severing it as he had hoped. The knife, deeply embedded in bone, stuck there. Fitz reached inside his sleeves and drew two more blades, longer and sharper versions of the sorcerous needles he more commonly used. Sir Hereward paused, went down on one knee, aimed for a second, and fired both pistols at the midsection of the godlet. One ball whizzed past, the other struck, but as far as he could tell, had no effect. The knight threw the pistols aside and drew his sword, charging onward with a wild shout he hoped would serve to distract the attention of the godlet from the real attack delivered by Filtak, who slipped over on the ice and fell, the godtaker sword sliding from his grasp. At that moment, Zava stopped, reached down to break a splintered piece of fallen bridge out of the ice, and turned to its pursuers, raising its makeshift weapon over its head. An oak beam longer than Hereward was tall, this terrible club was liberally dotted with iron bolts, and a single blow would doubtless be fatal. The godlet advanced on Hereward, who slipped and skidded backwards in an effort to arrest his forward momentum. Mr. Fitz circled around the godlet, needles ready. But even if he could successfully close, it was doubtful sharp steel could do more than irritate it. Filtak got to his feet. His lorgnette had fallen off, but he still spotted his sword upon the ice. He staggered over to it and lifted it with both hands. But the godlet paid him no attention, apparently completely fixated on Sir Hereward. It was only as it got closer he saw that Eudonia's eyes were open now, albeit crazed and washed with the violent violet light of remnant energy from the sorcerer's needles.
"Aberration!" spat the witch's mouth.
Clearly, the godlet was no longer fully in charge of the body, but this was not the hoped-for improvement Sir Hereward and Mr. Fitz had counted on, as his great-great-aunt's animosity to the boy witch had remained when so much else of her personality had been eroded in the long contest with the godlet.
"Aunt Eudonia!" cried Hereward.
He retreated again, but he could feel the ice cracking and shifting under his boot heels. Now the witch was back in charge, the godlet was not freezing the water.
"I charge you to assist us as an agent of the treaty." "Vile spawn!" muttered the witch,
following these words with a sudden smashing blow with the bridge timber that sent a fountain of exploded ice up into the air. Hereward leapt aside as the club came down and scuttled sideways for more solid ice, but his foot broke through and he fell forwards. Twisting around, he raised his sword in a futile attempt to block a further blow, just as Mr. Fitz jumped to the witch's shoulders and plunged his needles into the witch's insane eyes. Eudonia, or the godlet, or both, screamed. But it was a scream of rage rather than pain. It threw the timber away, narrowly missing Sir Hereward, and one hand grabbed Mr. Fitz and hurled him away too, far away, over the ice and into the water. Sir Hereward freed his foot and crawled on his elbows and knees over the ice, faster than he had ever crawled before. Half of him hoped the godlet, or Eudonia, or Zava, or whatever the thing behind him currently was, would follow and be distracted, and half of him desperately hoped it wouldn't. At the edge of the island, he hit mud instead of ice, rolled over, and looked back. Zava was following him, blind face pressed close to the lake's surface, nose sniffing, hands reaching, head twitching from side to side as it sought to catch sounds as well as scent. Filtak was behind it, moving with a peculiarly swift and liquid grace, the godtaker sword raised high, the brassard bright upon his arm.
"Eudonia! Zava! Over here!"
screamed Sir Hereward as he drew himself to his feet and readied himself to run as best he could. The godlet sprang up too, its legs bunched to spring forwards, just as Filtak swung his sword. The blade met the thing's neck and cut through with a sound like the mainmast of a great ship snapping in a hurricane, or an overpowered siege cannon blowing itself apart. The blade burned away like a powder trail as Filtak finished the cut, but the head toppled from the neck and rolled across the ice, which, in that same moment, was crazed with a thousand cracks. Filtak dropped the sword hilt, emitted a euphoric shout, took one step and fell through the ice into the smallest sea. A moment later, the unnaturally chilled waters also claimed the Godtaker sword hilt and burned out stub of a blade, and the body and head of Eudonia, with or without the godlet still within. Sir Hereward took three swift steps into the now open water, which was littered with tiny chunks of ice, similar to those chipped into the cool drinks of that same city of Simeril, which lay ahead and supplied Filtak's coffee. But he stopped when the water came to his waist. He was too heavily clothed and booted to swim, and the water was very cold. Besides, there was a small chance that Zavar Tish Lakish Tax was not in fact banished after all. He looked around for Mr. Fitz, fully expecting the puppet to have swum ashore. The puppet had done so, but Sir Hereward was shocked to see Mr. Fitz's upper body in its dripping blue jacket was canted to one side at an odd angle. Though made of papier-mâché and wood, the puppet was constructed of sorcerous versions of said materials, which were extraordinarily difficult to damage. But here he was, most evidently damaged.
"You are injured!"
exclaimed Hereward, rushing to his side. But the puppet waved him off.
"It is nothing," he said. "Merely the alignment of a joint in my spine, which I will adjust as soon as my sewing case is replenished. Have you seen any sign the godlet persists? Movement under the water?"
"No,"
replied Hereward, turning to gaze upon the ice cube-spattered waters.
"Yes, there."
A shadow was moving under the water. Sir Hereward and Mr. Fitz drew back as it broke through the surface in a sudden explosion of ice cubes. Filtak stood there, huffing and blowing and shivering, before quickly wading in to be greeted with a comradely backslap from Sir Hereward, who was rapidly readjusting his views on his unlooked-for ally.
"I thought you drowned for certain," exclaimed the knight. "In cuirass and boots and cloak, no man could swim ashore."
"Nor could they,"
coughed Filtak.
"I walked upon the bottom of the lake. I told you I was trained in the arts of the sponge divers of Zilu."
"And I am glad of it," exclaimed Sir Hereward. "Ah, did you perchance see anything of Zavar Tish Lakish Tax while you were down there?"
Filtak jumped and twisted about to look behind him.
"No,"
he cried, suddenly shaking even more.
"I had thought. It is banished, is it not?"
"I am not certain it is," replied Mr. Fitz. "The water clouds my sight."
The lopsided puppet shifted clumsily, turning his whole body rather than just his head, to gaze upon a stretch of water some 50 yards distant.
"It is still here," he said. "Greatly diminished, but still here."
Even as he spoke, a ghastly headless thing crawled out of the lake on all fours. It had lost not only its head, but the extra legs as well, torn off in the explosion caused by the conjoining of godlet-possessed sword and the entity within Eudonia's body. Despite raw gaping wounds at neck and hip, no blood flowed. It did not attempt to stand, but moved fully onto the land, pausing to shake itself, an unnerving sight given that it had no head.
What do we do?
Asked Filtak.
Move away quietly, said Mr. Fitz in a whisper.
The puppet followed his own advice, stepping out swiftly and surely, though his torso remained twisted.
Tread lightly, breathe shallowly, stay calm.
But it has no head, it cannot hear or see us,
said Philtak as he too hurried away, glancing anxiously back over his shoulder.
There are other senses, replied Mr. Fitz. I fear it will be swift once it locates us. But if we make that bridge, perhaps we can lure it into the water once more. Hereward, why do you stop?
Philtak ran on for several steps, only stopping when he realized Fitz had turned back. Puppet and Knight were looking to the sky, but Philtak could not tear his gaze away from the headless, broken thing that was now scuttling like a spider in a zigzag, backwards and forwards where Philtak had first left the water, somehow finding a trail of energetic scent, or something of that kind. Suddenly, a vast shadow passed over men and puppet, accompanied by a long, falling shriek of titanic proportion. Philtak thrust his hands against his ears and cowered down, all courage leached away by this new addition to their woes. But Sir Hereward kept looking up, a smile lifting the corner of his mouth. A moonshade swept past overhead, its enormous leathery wings spread wide, 120 feet or more. It turned its big-as-a-house furred bat-like head down and fixed Sir Hereward with one sharp black eye, an eye greater in diameter than the knight was tall. Opening its pink-lined, sharp-toothed, elongated jaw, it gave vent once more to its greeting call. The witch, who sat securely on the tall chair on its back, seemingly grown of the same shiny black bone as the creature's spine, added to the creature's screech with a jaunty wave. Sir Hereward smiled, for though she was very late, Kishtar was one of his favourite cousins, and a former lover besides, who might well be one again. The council back at the High Pale would not be expecting her to return for at least another week. But far more significantly, Kishtar was suitably equipped with both a god-slaying relic and a full sewing desk of sorcerous needles. The husk of Eudonia and the diminished extra-dimensional entity Zavatish Lakishtax within would offer her no challenges. She would swiftly banish the godlet and give whatever might remain of the woman peace. Hereward lost his smile at the thought of great-great-aunt Eudonia's head still somewhere out there under the lake's clouded surface. Pierced by 3 sorcerous needles and infused with an indomitable will that would not even surrender to a godlet, it was possible that Eudonia still lived, after a fashion, inside that sunken head. Kishtar's task might not be as straightforward as he had supposed, and worse, she might enlist him to go fishing. He most certainly did not want to hook and land Eudonia's separated head.
What is that?
Asked Philtak, creeping up to man and puppet. He could see that, whatever it was, its arrival had disturbed the remnant relic of Zavatish Lakishtax, which had retreated back to the lakeshore and was now trying to bury itself in the mud, presumably in an effort to conceal itself from this new airborne nemesis.
It is a moonshade bearing a witch of Har, answered Mr. Fitz, responding literally, as was his wont. The long-awaited Kishtar, in fact.
The huge flying creature turned about to land on the longer and broader shore on the northern side of their current island. Despite their enormous size, moonshades were nimble and agile flyers, and could set down in a space only a little longer than their own length. Once landed, they could fold their wings up remarkably small, as this one was in the process of doing. They were, in fact, deceptive in their size, being mostly leathery skin and thin bones, with a little black fur dab here and there. Though, even when all was said and done, it was still a monster roughly the size of a watchtower laid on its side.
"More to the point," said Sir Hereward, dragging the smaller man upright and draping his arm over his shoulder in a comradely fashion. "The Moonshade and the witch who rides it represent an opportunity which I believe we should take at once."
"An opportunity?"
"To shuck off our cares and responsibility and hie ourselves to yonder Simmeril, where I will purchase both of us some more of that excellent coffee."
He paused and added with a wink to the puppet,
"And some sweet oil, for I, for one, would like to hear Mr. Fitz sing."
Ellen Kushner. Ellen Kushner's first novel, Swords Point, introduced readers to Riverside, home of the city to which she has since returned in The Privilege of the Sword, a Locus Award winner and Nebula nominee, The Fall of the Kings, written with Delia Sherman, a handful of related short stories, and most recently, the collaborative Riverside prequel Tremontaine for SerialBox.com and Saga Press. The author herself recorded all three novels in audiobook form for Neil Gaiman Presents, Audible.com, winning a 2012 Audie Award for Swords Point. With Holly Black, she co-edited Welcome to Bordertown, a revival of the original urban fantasy shared world series created by Terry Windling. A popular performer and public speaker, Ellen Kushner created and hosted the long-running public radio show Sound and Spirit, which Bill Moyers called the best thing on public radio. She has taught creative writing at the Clarion and Odyssey workshops and is an instructor in Holland University's Children's Literature MFA program. She lives in New York City with Delia Sherman and no cats whatsoever, in an apartment full of theater and airplane ticket stubs. Here she introduces us to a young man newly arrived in Riverside to seek his fortune, one who, like many young men come to the big city before him, finds that he's got a lot to learn to succeed, and that many of the lessons aren't pleasant.
When I Was a Highwayman, Ellen Kushner. "Do it," Jess said. "It'll be fun." I had no wish to be a highwayman, even for a day, but we needed the money, so I considered it. Since I had come to Riverside, I'd learned that not everyone there gives a stranger from the country good advice. If Riversiders advise a new blade to challenge that guy over there by the fire to a duel, you can take him no problem. Well, it's lucky that you do turn out to be better than he is. Of course, now he hates you and won't recommend you for any jobs uptown, which is where the glory and the money are. Bad advice. But since Jessamine and I had begun keeping company toward the end of winter, I'd learned she usually had my best interests at heart, especially when it came to advice about making money. She was expert at that herself, the cleverest con artist the city had to offer, according to her admirers, and the slyest shyster ever to pick a pocket, according to the others. Jessamine was pretty, too. A mane of moon-pale hair such as I had never seen before, fun to get tangled in at night, fun to braid up tight in the morning so she looked like a middle city girl, decent yet delectable. That was how she played her game. We made a good pair. Silver and smoke, ice and steel, people said. I could go anywhere with her. Suddenly, all the taverns of Riverside were open to me, even the Maiden's Fancy, where women like Flash Annie and Kathy Blunt told one another their secrets. Everyone knew Jess, and if they didn't like her, at least they admired her skill and the way she took marks in Uptown. She knew the handkerchief trick, the lost baby trick, The Pigeon Drop, and The Lover's Dare. I never went on jobs with her, though, because it was important for people to know my face if I was going to get work, and it was very, very important that no one remember hers. Jessamine had a wardrobe a duchess would envy, for quantity if not for quality. Velvet with the nap rubbed away in back, raveled silk stockings, lace frontlets and silk shawls stained underneath, ribbons in every color imaginable to trim and retrim her many hats, feathers picked up on the street. "It just has to look right, Richard," she'd explain. "No one's going to lift up my fine linen skirt to see the patched petticoats underneath. If I paint a thing gold and wear it like it's gold, only a jeweler will know it's not." She arched her neck, laughing. "And I never get anywhere near a real jeweler, so that's no problem." I stroked the nape of her smooth neck, where the soft hair grew in an arrow shape. "I'll get you near a real one. We're going to make money, Jessamine. I'm going to make it. A swordsman can get rich in this town. Look at Rivers. And Damaris, before his last fight. I'm going to be better than them. And then we'll go up to Lassiter's Row and buy you gold earrings with jewels in them, the biggest they've got." I didn't know much about jewels then, not their names, nor what they were worth, really. I just liked the way they sparkled, catching the sun with a rainbow's fire. I'd only seen my first diamond at a merchant's wedding I was playing guard at. I'd thought it was a composite of all other jewels, compressed into one, till someone set me right. Jess and I shared a couple of rooms upstairs in a crumbling old house on a narrow street full of them. Like its neighbors, it had been grand and glorious once, before the rich abandoned Riverside to move over the bridge into the rest of the city. Our two rooms still had carvings and fancy molding clinging to the peeling walls. There was plenty of space for Jess's massive collection of costumes. The house's owner was a laundress who plied her trade in the courtyard's ancient stone well and rented out her upstairs rooms by the week, which suited us fine. Whenever either of us got or did a job, we'd pay Marie her rent first, then go out and spend the rest on whatever pleased our fancy. Dresses and hats and fine cloaks for Jessamine, really just business, she explained, and whatever pretty flotsam had turned up in the old market at the heart of Riverside. Stuff salvaged from crumbling houses, things no one could pawn, like cracked porcelain vases, a fragment of gilded picture frame, a carved boxwood figure with its arms missing. The money for that I got from working a wedding uptown, the most boring job in the world. I always felt ridiculous with my sword out and that stupid wreath on my head, marching behind the bridal party to the temple, then standing there on display while the priests read the same words over each couple. It's not as though anyone was ever coming to actually steal away the bride. Jess said it was a way to get noticed, and I was lucky I looked good in a wreath. "You're what, barely 18? She'd asked, knowing perfectly well I wasn't even that yet. "There's time." But I hadn't come to the city to stand around watching people get married. Everyone here in Riverside knew I was a serious duelist. Sometimes I was able to prove it there, when another swordsman got fresh with Jess, or a new blade came down looking for trouble and decided to see if I was any good. Still, it was from working a wedding that I finally got a chance to prove myself to the ones who counted. I'd gotten the job because Hugo Seville was already scheduled for a demonstration duel at some hill noble's birthday party, lucky stiff, so he'd passed the wedding job on to me. "I'm recommending you because I know you'll do your best," he said pompously, as though there was real effort involved in standing very still and not scratching your nose. "These people are important, Richard. Lord Hastings never comes to town, but he's here to marry off his seventh daughter to Condell's eldest." I could never remember their names. I just put on my clean shirt and my blue doublet, polished my boots, and went over the bridge. It was a very fancy wedding. A whole band of musicians walked us to the temple, not just one or two flute players. Little girls tossed lavender and rosemary in the bride's path. When we stepped on the herbs, the scent made me suddenly homesick for my mother's garden. I wasn't the only swordsman either. Lord Hastings had a house sword who walked beside me, a tall, quiet, older man who didn't want trouble. I could tell by the way he gave me enough space, and I appreciated that. Lord Hastings' blade and I left the temple together, well after the musicians had played the wedding party and their guests away. Our part was done. I guess the bride belonged to her husband's family now. Hastings' swordsman was no riversider, maybe one of those men who learn from an academy, or even from their fathers, and make their way up in a nobleman's service, fighting exhibition duels, doing weddings, showing off grace and form, and standing ready in case anyone tries to challenge their noble masters. I'd never really gotten the chance to talk to one of them. The last wedding with two swords, the other wouldn't answer any questions. And when I challenged him after, he spat and called me Riverside Gutter Trash, the poser. I was beginning to think about asking Lord Hastings, quiet swordsman, how to get work as a duelist uptown, when suddenly he staggered and fell against the wall. "Are you hurt?" I said. He was very pale. A woman in a simple dress with bright starched cap and collar came running up. "Oh, George, George, I told you were too ill for this today."
"Marjorie," he grinned feebly at her, "how could I disappoint his lordship after all this time? And little Omelette, lucky seventh, right? Didn't she look lovely?"
"You're going to disappoint him even more now, for you're in no fit shape to duel for the guests at the party." He'd started shivering. Some kind of fever, I guessed. There were a lot of those in the city.
"They've seen me fight before, many times. They'll like seeing someone new. What's your name, boy?"
I let the boy go because he was so ill. "Richard St. Vere."
"Of the banking St. Vere's?" the woman asked.
"Do I look like a banker?" But I said it with a smile. I'd gotten used to that question here. My mother had once been a daughter of that family, but that was no one's business but hers. "I am a swordsman, madam, and I would be happy to take up this duel if you will tell me where to go."
"Come, George." She had her arms around him. "I'll take you home. And you, Master St. Vere, if you could just give me a hand with him. No, of course you don't need one, George, but I do. I'll give you directions to Lord Condell's. You've got plenty of time. There's all the eating and drinking before the entertainment."
I'd never been up on the hill before, where the nobles' fine houses were. They didn't want you there if you weren't working for them. But this time, I was. So I walked boldly along the wide open streets lined with the walls and massive iron gates of great houses on either side. An occasional carriage passed me, one of theirs, flash with high-headed horses and glitzy harnesses, or a liveried servant, on foot, out on some errand I couldn't imagine. At Lord Condell's house, I gave my name, explained my business, and assured them that I was not there to challenge their master at his son's wedding feast. They reminded me that I was to use the back entrance, but that cook might have something hot for me. Lord Condell's servants were all madly busy with the feast and didn't have time for me. So I went out to the side yard to warm up and practice my moves until someone came out to tell me it was time. The duel was to be held in the entry hall of the house. Very dressed-up people encircled the space, many of them on the landing to the main stairs,
and more of them crowding the stairs themselves or leaning from the upstairs balcony. I walked slowly, trying to look like I knew what I was doing. The people didn't matter, but my opponent did. He was a fair man of about my size and reach. I stood across the hall from him while a liveried man announced,
"For the honor and pleasure of the bride and groom, the duel will be to first blood, or until one man yields."
I knew about first blood. It could mean a scratch, a slash, or a deep puncture wound. I imagined duels at a wedding feast called for just a scratch, and took a long breath to remind myself to go no further in this bout. After a few more formalities, it began. My opponent and I moved slowly, testing, observing, as is right. We circled each other. The crowd was silent. In Riverside, they would have started shouting bets already. I made a feint to see what he'd do, and he did nothing but raise his eyebrows and cock up one corner of his mouth at me. Not easily drawn, this was going to be a longer fight than I'd expected. We let the swords converse a little, back and forth, feeling each other's strength and the pressure of the blades, trying to hide our real abilities from each other. Suddenly, his high wrist dropped and he struck low like a swooping falcon, but I'd felt it coming and countered easily. He stepped back, surprised, to give himself time to assess and to avoid me. Once they start stepping back, you have them. I pressed forward, 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 quickly, not giving him time to think, showing off a new move every time for those who could see fast enough, wanting to impress them all. He defended himself ably, but I never let him pick up an attack, just kept pushing him back. He was a pleasure to fight, because I knew it would be hard to make my touch on him, but that he didn't stand a chance at hitting me. When we closed together with our quillens crossed, he hissed at me, "What are you doing? Fall back!" I understood his words only well enough to gasp, "What? No!" He turned his blade so that we half-circled each other, still close together. "This is for their entertainment. They want to see some back and forth." I disengaged, sliding my blade back along his until their tips alone touched. We messed around like that for a bit, like some kind of kiddie training exercise, circling each other, circling the blades. The noble guests were enchanted. They seemed to think something was happening and started shouting encouragement. I saw a woman's face, very white, her hands twisting a handkerchief as though there were real danger here. Were these the arbiters of skill? The people I was so eager to impress? My opponent thought he held the match in his hand, that having acceded to his suggestion, I would let him control the finish. With a triumphant grin, he advanced ferociously. I fell back just long enough to gauge my distance and leap in over his blade, touching him in the upper breast as gently as I could manage. It drew blood. The bout was over. My opponent bowed and was helped away by a footman. I stood there in the hallway with shouts of "Blood!" and "Bravo!" ringing in my ears, wondering what I should do next. A servant brought me a silver cup filled with a cool drink. When I'd emptied it, the nobles started crowding around me, congratulating me, asking my name. How long had I been in Lord Hastings' employ? Did I take commissions? What was my next fight? Where could they find me? To be honest, it was a little too much. Success was wonderful, new jobs were wonderful, but the people all moving in and out of my vision, arms and hands and heads, right after I'd been fighting. "Richard St. Vere," I said. "My name is St. Vere, and you can find me in Riverside, at the Maiden's Fancy. Thank you, yes, thank you. I must..." I have to go and clean my blade. Really, it's important. If you'd just let me through...
Absolutely.
A young man with soft, curling brown hair and one red jewel in his ear raised a hand where I could see it and slowly put his arm around my shoulder. They fell back a little when he did that, and I was grateful.
You must go and refresh yourself, Master Saint Vere. Allow me to assist you.
The crowds parted for us. He was in lace and velvet, one of them.
Have you been paid? He murmured. I shook my head. Well, never mind. Condal is busy now. You can come back tomorrow.
Instead of a way toward the kitchens, he led me out the big front door. The air on the steps was cooler.
Just a moment, he said. Stay here while I send for my carriage.
The seats in the nobleman's carriage were soft as down. It smelt a little of leather, a little of horses, and a little of the man himself, a scent like roses and amber.
My name is Thomas Barone, he told me.
He rested his gloved hand on my leg for a moment, and I let him.
Please allow me to take you wherever you wish to go.
He ducked his head slightly.
This includes my own rooms, if you would be so kind as to have it so.
I thought, why not? Jess wouldn't mind. She was out some nights herself, keeping up contacts, solidifying friendships, forging alliances, or just plain having fun. She might even be pleased to learn that I had been taken home by a lordling. Lord Thomas Barone was courtesy itself. When we came to his family townhouse, we took a side entrance so as not to alarm my parents, and went up one set of stairs, then another, into a room all rosy with velvet and firelight, shadows playing on a glint of painting here, a fall of tapestry there. He was beautiful without his clothes on, and he knew how to please me. My boyhood friend Crispin and I had had our little rituals, but Thomas Barone was a grown man who clearly had a lot of practice. All that night, when I woke to the fall of the light on his skin, or the candles guttering, or a glass of wine being sleepily handed to me, I felt oddly safe and oddly happy. He asked very few questions, but I found myself telling him about my hopes for work, my wish to challenge worthy opponents, to duel to my utmost strength and skill. Until I had come to the city, I hadn't realized I was that good. I thought everyone could do what I do, more or less, with the right training. My drunk old master, a wanderer my mother had taken in off the road out of pity, who had trained me mercilessly, always told me not to be too sure of myself. I took that to heart. But he had also taught me how to assess an opponent and how to take advantage of their every weakness. The men I'd fought so far in the confines of Riverside were no match for me. Those who were steered clear of my sword. There were no demonstration bouts in Riverside. Thomas Barone was only a little older than me, not yet 20, as he admitted, and so, though his father was rich, he wasn't, and he was also a second son. What funds he had went to collecting objects of art, and he hoped I didn't take offense if he said I was one of the finest. Not that I could afford your true price. I asked what he thought that was, wondering uneasily if he was planning to pay me. That would make me a nobleman's whore, which was far from my ambition. He kissed me, said this was an open exchange of willing hearts. He said that my skill with the sword might be for the marketplace, but when it came to... Well, I can't honestly remember what he said, but it was along those lines. You couldn't exactly call it morning when we finally got out of bed to drink the chocolate his valet had brought in. It was amazing stuff. You couldn't get anything like that in Riverside. There were crisp white rolls, too, and butter so sweet it must have come from the country. In the light of day, I admired the nobleman's treasures, the tapestry of lovers in a rose garden that covered half a wall, the ancient chest carved with deer and oak leaves, gleaming with beeswax. Even the bed curtains were works of art, embroidered with moons and stars. I picked up something small, an ivory statue of a boy king, with his many braids and naked chest, barely bigger than my palm. "I know you can't afford a swordsman," I told him lightly, trying not to want it too much, "but I'd fight a challenge for this." Thomas Barone's lips curved. His curly hair was tousled, and his mouth was the kissable color of certain roses. "You have good taste," he said. "You could fight a dozen challenges for that, and still not come near its worth." I put it down carefully. "Now then," Lord Thomas kissed my shoulder, "I am expected somewhere, and I imagine you are too. It will, however, take me much longer to be made presentable to the outside world. So if you'd like me to call my carriage to carry you up to Lord Condell's..." I shook my head. Their houses were so close, I was amazed that he felt the need to ride between them. "Well then," Lord Thomas said, "let me assist you in dressing, to make up for being so eager to undress you last night." As he slipped the linen shirt over my head, I realized that it was much finer than my own. I didn't say anything. He probably had chests full of them, and if this was the gift he wanted to give me, well, having a third shirt to my name was only to the good. I found Jessamine at the Maiden's Fancy, drinking with our friend Kathy Blunt. "Well, if it isn't the great Saint Vere!" Jess tipped her chair back. "And here I thought you'd run off with the bride." "She wouldn't have me," I said casually, "so I fought a duel instead." "Yeah, at Lord Condell's, I heard." I'd been looking forward to telling her myself. "Nimble Willie was just up there checking it out for Kathy's ma and her gang. He went as a delivery boy, and they were all bragging about your fight in the kitchens." I spilled Lord Condell's coins on the table in front of her. Kathy, at least, had the grace to look impressed. Jess just grabbed one and held it up like a prize. "Rosalie, this is for the tab, and for another round. For the house, for luck, for Annie." She was far from sober. "Where's Annie?" I said. "What happened?" Kathy wiped her eyes with the back of her hand. "Annie got nabbed yesterday morning. They whipped her today in Justice Place. Jessamine went and I went with her, so she knew we both was there in the crowd." "We're there," Jess corrected savagely. "You'll never make it uptown if you talk like that, Kath. You'll end up just like Annie. Rotten straw from the jail in your hair, your dress torn open for them to see your tits while they whip you for stealing what they wish they had." "Shut up!" Kathy pushed back from the table so fast, her bench tipped over. "You just shut up, Jessamine Fancy Pants! You think you're any better? You may be able to pass uptown for an hour's grift, but you drink and you fuck down here in Riverside with the rest of us." I knew Kath had a knife up her sleeve, but she made no move to use it, so I just watched as she knuckled her eyes with her fist, rose, and dashed out of the tavern. Jess made a face. "Cheapskate didn't even pay her tab," she said. She took another coin from my pile. "But that's all right. We've got plenty to spend now, love, haven't we? Let's go see if Salamander still has that snake-headed dagger you liked." I put my hand over hers. "Rent first," I said. "That's the rule. And while we're back there, maybe we should go upstairs." I put my hands behind her head, weaving my fingers in her moonlight hair, and I kissed her there in the tavern. I wanted her so much. She slid her free hand down my thigh. "Rules are rules," she said. "Let's go pay the rent and have some fun." The snake-headed dagger was gone, but Salamander had a plain one with a balance so perfect it could have been made for me. We got that and a dagger made of glass because it was just so unbelievable, and bangles for Jess that Sal said came from Cham, and 5 silver forks that ended in nymphs' heads. Then we went over to Maddie's to see what clothing she had in. Jessamine carefully scrutinized all the servants' cast-offs for the best, dresses made over from hand-me-downs of generous mistresses that could be tarted up to look new. She found a skirt and petticoat almost perfect, and a bundle of collars and neckerchiefs Mad let her have for cheap, because they'd been scorched by a careless ironing maid. Jessamine spent some time cooing over an old bodice of gold thread brocade, most of its tiny silk rosettes still intact, but then said she had no use for it. I bought it for her anyway, just for fun. We found plenty of use for it back home. We went on spending freely because we knew there would be more, and that spring there was. Nobles started sending emissaries down to the maiden, offering me jobs. Demonstration bouts, mostly, for parties and things, still no actual duels. But Jess and our friend Ginny Vandal said to be patient. That was how you got noticed. Ginny knew everything about swordsmen. She didn't like it when I turned down Lord Condell's offer to spend a month on his summer estates. I told her I'd just come from the country, and I didn't want to turn around and go back there. I didn't say I didn't want to leave Jess for so long, but that was clear. Then Jess got pregnant, despite all our care, and it was expensive to get rid of it. She was sick for a while after and couldn't go out on jobs. That was when the money started drying up for me, too. I went over all my recent paying duels, trying to figure out what I'd done wrong. Was I too predictable? Should I have let someone beat me just the once? "I could have told you," Ginny said. "Take all the work while you can get it. Yeah, even the weddings, Richard, because guess what? Summer's coming, and they all go to the country, not just Lord Condell. No one needs a swordsman here in summer." "Richard only takes the jobs he wants now." Jess coiled around me on the settle like a big white cat. We both knew Ginny fancied me like Mad, but whatever I got up to on the hill, I had only one love in Riverside. "He's sick of weddings. Everyone knows he's the best. We'll be just fine till their lordships come home in the fall and start having fun again." First, we had to pawn the nymph forks and sell the brocade bodice, then pawn Jessamine's winter clothes. "I'll get them back," she said with a shrug, "soon as I'm better." When that day came, we braided her hair up tight again, and she went across the bridge to find a mark and make some money with the turned-out servant girl trick. "I'm thin enough now," she grinned at me. "It'll be a snap." Jess came home with a kerchief full of apples, bread, and new cheese, and we gorged ourselves on food and kisses. But when I lifted her skirts, I found her petticoats were gone. "I'll get them back," she said fiercely. "It's my stuff. I can do what I want with it. I just wasn't ready yet." I sold the green glass and the armless statue because the salamander wouldn't take them in pawn. Maddie bought back most of Jess's linen. "Your luck will turn," she said, and pressed one of the scorched collars back into Jessamine's hands. "A girl's got to earn a living. Don't worry, love, I've seen it before. You'll come around." If there were any wedding jobs, I would have taken them, but it seemed summer wasn't a good time for weddings either. That was when Marco and Ivan came up with their grand scheme. We were drinking at Rosalie's because her tavern is underground, in the cellar of an old townhouse. The cellar was god-awful damp in winter, but in summer it was a blessing. Even her beer was relatively cool, and Rosalie was one of the few who still let us eat on credit.
Richard St. Vere!
They strolled on up to our table, feathers in their hats and a swagger in their stride.
Have you ever been on the highway?
Of course I've been on the highway. How do you think I got here? Ivan poked Marco in the ribs.
I like this kid. He's got a sense of humor.
Jess just sat there with a little smile at the corner of her lips, watching the show.
Richard.
Marco leaned into the table. He was unarmed, so I let him.
Where do you think this hat came from? Or these buckles? Or these shoes?
I waited. They were really ugly buckles.
From noblemen's coaches, that's where. Out on the highway, where they pass to and fro without a care, just waiting for gentlemen like us to stop and relieve them of some of their gold.
And personal effects, said Ivan, stroking the world's gaudiest hat pin. Marco turned to Jessamine.
There are ladies too, you know. Miserable old hags wearing silks and jewels they should have left off long ago to adorn some younger, sprightlier dame.
Jessamine nodded. Go on, Richard, she said brightly. You should try it. You can get me some new petticoats. I asked, what would I have to do?
There's a carriage coming by, Marco said. Tomorrow morning, carrying all kinds of fancy stuff. I had it from Fat Tom, whose brother's wife's cousin works up on the hill and knows the guy who's driving. All we have to do is lie in wait at a particular bend in the road we happen to be familiar with, well hid from any passers-by. You step out and challenge the driver. The coach stops and...
Who did they think I was?
I'm not challenging any driver!
A sword fights only other swords. Jess stroked my arm. You don't challenge him, not really, just get him to stop.
Or we can do that, Ivan said hastily. We can stop him if you want. It just looks better when you do it. You know, with a sword. But there's a guard, Marco explained. A footman usually, not a blade, but trained with knives and stuff. Sometimes two of them, plus the coachman. That's where you come in.
Scare 'em off. They'll know what swords can do. They respect that. You just round 'em up and keep 'em still. Look menacing. Don't let 'em pull any tricks while we rifle the coach. Then we're off. Off in the bushes or off on a horse? Jess asked. Marco looked pious.
We always rent Brown Bess. She is most reliable. And has a very smooth trot.
She's not going to carry three.
They're not going to chase after a swordsman.
It sounded like hell to me. I'd rather do weddings. But that wasn't entirely true, and Jess knew it. At least you'll get to fight, Richard, she said. Or pretend to, anyway. You can fix them with that awful stare you get when you're practicing. And I promise you won't be bored.
Easy money, Marco said.
Do it, Jess said. It'll be fun. I was plenty bored. Marco and Ivan appeared on Brown Bess at the white part of dawn, when many Riversiders were just coming home off jobs. They let me ride up behind them, and we plodded along the highway for a long time, until we came to their particular spot. Ivan tied up Bess in the woods, and we lay on a verge in the still damp grass, watching the road. And watching the road. And watching the road. I fell asleep for a little bit. Then Ivan nudged me with a, "Here they come!" But it was only a delivery cart, its two mules laboring slowly up the slope.
Remember, Marco murmured when it had passed, don't kill anyone.
It is very important that you don't kill anyone. Why? For robbery, you get jailed and lashed. For murder, you swing. All of us. I said nothing. Yeah, said Ivan. It's a funny old world. You kill a guy in a duel for them? It's right as rain, no questions asked. We kill someone by accident while trying to make a living, and it's up the gibbet to do the solo jig. Of course, Marco added, if you do kill anyone, if we do, I mean, you'd better kill them all. Why? So they don't tell. That way we've got a chance. I was very, very sorry I'd come. This was all I needed, to be marked out a common murderer, and with a true blade yet. That would be the end of me as a swordsman, the end of everything my old master had taught me. All for nothing. Hey now, Marco must have seen my frown. Nobody's getting killed here. The highway life is all gold and glory. Don't let anyone tell you otherwise. They may even write a song about you. You know, like that one about Dapper Dan or whatever his name is. He started singing, Dapper Dan, Dapper Dan, steals your wife and bones your... Shh! Ivan flapped his hand at us. They're coming! This time, they truly were. Matched white horses pulled a gorgeous carriage. It looked strangely familiar to me. And when Ivan and Marco had stopped it, pulled the coachman off his perch while I held the horses, then had me threaten the footman with my blade until he and the coachman were safely tied up together, I found out why. Marco banged on the door of the carriage with the butt of his knife, scarring the painted coat of arms with a certain pleasure. The young nobleman who emerged was very familiar indeed. Hello, Thomas, I said. Richard! He looked almost pleased. What are you doing here? I'm afraid my associates and I are going to take all your money and jewels now. Lord Thomas Barone was scared, I could tell, but he handled it well. Though his hand was shaking, he kept his voice even and his head high. If you must, you must, he said. My father will be very upset. But when I explain how you outnumbered us, I'm sure he'll understand. This is messed up, Ivan said, craning around the horses to see what was going on. Stop talking and knock him out. I hesitated. It was messed up. Marco sighed gustily. All right, we get it, Richard. The one noble in town you actually know, you've worked for him. You don't want to lose a patron. Just our luck. As usual. You should have come masked. Just so, said Lord Thomas, in that soft and friendly way of his. It is unfortunate that we had to meet again like this, Master St. Vere. The watch and my father will demand a full description of the criminals. He pointed his chin at Marco. You, gentlemen, of course, I do not know. Both his hands were shaking badly now. I was surprised he was still standing, because usually the knees go first. My father is hard to lie to, but I will try. How kind, Marco sneered. What for? Barone turned to me. If I might ask in return that you would consent to visit me again, soon? Yes, I said, surprised. I would like that. See, Richard, Marco crowed, and you even got a job out of it. Now let's bash him on the head and get this over with. Barone paled, and Marco said with savage cheer, Fathers like it when we bash you on the head. I'd rather you didn't, Thomas said desperately. I have a very soft head. My father says so. Shut up, snapped Marco, but I said, Wait. Richard, what the hell are you doing? Knocking him out, I said. I knew Thomas closed his eyes when he kissed and kept them closed. So I sheathed my sword and put my arms around him and my damp cloak as well, hiding Ivan and Marco from his sight and he from theirs. It was sort of lovely, the way his whole body was shaking against me. I kissed him, and after a while, he started kissing back, a thing he does very well. Behind us, Marco and Ivan were looting the carriage. I murmured with pleasure, so Thomas wouldn't hear them, wouldn't think about it. He pressed in closer to me. His hands had stopped shaking, were moving against my back. I wasn't sure how long either of us was going to be able to remain standing. I wanted to shove him up against the side of the carriage, which would be foolish, or against one of those god-awful trees, which would be difficult. The more I thought about it, the more I wanted to. So it was a relief when I heard Marco say, "Let's go." "What about his rings?" Ivan whined. I unpeeled myself from Thomas Barone. "Leave the goddamned rings," I said harshly, not quite master of my breath. "Get in the coach, Thomas, and keep your head down." Luggage was scattered across the road, shirts and stockings and waistcoats and broken open boxes and books. "Leave it. Leave it and get in." "No, don't, Marco." But this time, they didn't heed me. Marco elbowed him in the kidneys, then bound his hands with a neckcloth, stuffed a stocking in his mouth, and left Lord Thomas Barone in his coach for the next traveler to find. As arranged, we met up at the Four Horse Quarters, a tavern on a side road to Azay. About a mile outside of town, Marco and Ivan were in the back room, organizing their takings, which ranged from plentiful coins to jeweled neck pins. They were delighted to see me. "So," Ivan said, practically bouncing on his toes, "we're gonna do that again, right?"
"Not really."
"Not really? But it was perfect. You're even more than a gentleman robber. You're the robber lover. There'll be songs out there in a week. Less."
"Not just songs," Marco leered. "They'll be lining up on the high road to get knocked out by you."
"Just watch you don't knock 'em up," said Ivan, which was his idea of humor.
"No," I said again, taking the flagon from in front of him and drinking it straight down. "I spent hours in the grass getting bored and wet. I'm going to have to oil my sword again, and I didn't really use it. I had to walk all the way back here, and I missed a whole day's practice." Marco sat back a little, his hands on the table.
"And the money?"
"I'll take it." Jess and I lived well for a few weeks. We got her linen back, and I bought her a dress, nearly new, white with bright flowers scattered all over it. She put it on to go uptown to do the missing pocket trick, her braids tidy, her skirts neat, looking for all the world like the pampered daughter of a country gentleman. She came home late, red-faced and drunk, her hair in a half-knot, the rest straggling down her front. I hadn't realized how dark it had gotten. I'd been practicing, which is important whether you have work or not, and I don't really need to see if there's no one else there.
"Look," she said. "Look what he gave me."
She parted her hair to display a gold necklace, curly-cued and jeweled.
"Dipped," she said, "and fake, but it'll be real next time."
Her kiss tasted of brandy. That was her favorite when she could get it.
"I'm coming up in the world."
I didn't ask her what happened. Sometimes things just did. I had to hear it from Nimble Willie that Jess had nearly been nabbed up on Tilton Street. But the man with the necklace had stepped forward and vouched for her to the watch. Then he offered her a drink. She sold the necklace and bought more dresses. When she came back from her expeditions in town, she didn't boast of her sharp cons the way she used to.
Sometimes she didn't want to talk at all. That gave me more time to practice. It was a hot summer, and our rooms were stifling. Jess thought I should go drill out in the courtyard, but that was too public. The moves I practiced were mine. A winning fight is where they don't have any idea what you're likely to do next. Jess said my endless practice was no fun, and she started spending more time out at Riverside Taverns. That might not have been such a great idea. I could see for myself that her hands were shaky sometimes. Picking gentlemen's pockets would be out of the question, and yet she came home with all kinds of gauds and bangles. Coming up in the world, she'd tell anyone who asked her. Marks can be so stupid if you know how to manage them. And no one contradicted her, maybe because she shared some of her trinkets out with her friends at the Maiden's Fancy, the ones she didn't keep, the ones she didn't sell. You'd think she had enough stuff to play with, but she started messing with my things as well, prancing around the room in nothing but my sword belt, playing childish games with my dragon candlesticks, going through all my shirts looking for holes over and over. When she tried to mess with my good knives, I'd had it. Those edges are perfect and needed to remain that way. They're not toys, I told her, and they're not yours. Leave them be. So she picked up the glass dagger and wound her bright, heavy hair up off her neck with one hand, pinning it in place with the blade. It looked good, and I told her so. She just tossed her head, "Glad you like it," and went out. From then on, I kept both knives on me, the weight balancing my hips. It was a warm evening, and I was practicing. Jessamine and I had woken early that morning and taken our pleasure together slowly and lazily for once, until the sun blazed through the cracks in the shutters, and we unstuck ourselves from the sweaty unit we had become. I lay in bed, drying myself with a corner of the sheet, watching Jessamine sponge herself off with the water in the basin. She was like an ivory statue herself, pale body with its smooth and perfect curves, hair pale in the shadows, falling like a river carved by a careful hand. She didn't ask me for help braiding her hair. Quickly and efficiently, she did it in one long, thick plait, and then she gave it a twist and secured it with the glass dagger. She dressed in a white linen smock and a blue linen kirtle and bodice, then started draping herself with some of the trinkets she'd been collecting. I thought they looked garish, but I didn't say anything. She didn't like it when I had opinions. She said she knew her business best. "I'm off," she said. I said, "Do you have to go?" "Oh, yes," she answered brightly. "He's taking me to luncheon at the King's Head." I'd never heard of the place. I fell back asleep for a bit. Then I got up and washed in the courtyard, dressed, and went out to find something to eat. There were no messages of employment for me at the Maiden's Fancy. Rosalie hadn't heard of any stray jobs either, so I went home to practice. I was working on a new move that a blade in my last duel had nearly taken me down with. First, I had to see my opponent clearly, and then I had to become him, executing the sequence so slowly that a child could have pierced through it, before speeding up, faster and faster. The light was fading when Jess came waltzing in with a bright, fringed shawl. She tried to tickle me with the fringe. I shook her off, the way you do a fly. She knew better than to disturb me when I was working. I'd told her a dozen times. "Richard," she sang, "how do you like my new duds?" "Later." Sweat was pouring down my chest, but I had to get the new move solid in my body so I knew it was there to count on next time, so fast my next opponent would never see it coming. "Oh, come on," she teased. She darted in to flick me with that shawl, like a kid taking a dare, and darted back out. "Stop it, Jess," It's not wise to come at a swordsman unannounced.
No, you stop it!
She started marching around the edges of my vision in a distracting little semicircle.
You can practice later. Don't you want to have some fun?
I don't like fun.
You don't, do you? Not anymore.
She worked her bodice loose, bared a shoulder to me like some girl on the street. I saw it out of the corner of my eye, but I ignored her.
Like what you see?
Will you please?
I'm not just here to decorate the room, you know.
I know. I tried to keep my sharpness and attack for my drill, but it came out in my voice.
I know, now will you please shut up?
I will not shut up!
She shrieked, a sudden explosion, and she grabbed my free arm, a move I was not expecting.
You look at me and you listen to me!
Sweat was dripping into my eyes so I could hardly see.
You don't care about me, you country son of a bitch! All you care about is your sword! You'd be dead if it weren't for me!
I don't know how I even understood the words. They were so loud and high.
You think you're too good to go out and earn your living like the rest of us? Well, let me tell you, I do what I can to survive. Do you even notice? You think you're some nobleman? You think you're too fine to do anything but practice until your next big duel?
The noise was intolerable.
When did you get so fancy, huh? When did you get too good for the rest of us?
I didn't know how to make her stop.
Look at you, waiting here at home for me to come back with whatever I can get for whatever I have to do, and it's hard, but you think I've lost my style. I've got plenty of style, more than you'll ever have. You can't even get a job. I haven't lost my nerve. I have plenty of nerve left when it comes to horse sons like you. Riverside doesn't want you. I don't want you.
She pulled the glass dagger from her hair. Silver tumbled all around her, so there must have been moonlight. She was coming at me with the knife, still saying those things. I had to make her stop. The moon was so bright, it cast shadows all around. Kathy Blunt came by in the morning, with the sun barely up. She knocked on the door again and again, and when she opened it, she stared at what she saw and stuck both fists in her mouth. She was screaming, I tried to tell her, and Kathy turned and ran. After that, people steered clear of me for a while. It was a respectful distance, and I didn't mind. I never like it when people crowd me. Then a new swordsman came to town, flashy and boastful, annoying as hell. I challenged him on the street, killed him clean and fair with one blow, straight to the heart, and after that, I was Riverside's own true blade again. Ginny Vandal was annoyed because she'd just taken up with Hugo Seville, and it would be dangerous to dump him now, not to mention foolish. Hugo did weddings. Hugo did demonstration bouts. Hugo would fight a golden retriever if it made him popular with the nobles or the merchants paid him enough. I didn't go back to the maiden's fancy, even at summer's end. The stew at Rosalie's was better, and my credit seemingly inexhaustible. So it was there that Marco and Ivan found me, back from their summer jaunt up north, and greeted me like a long-lost friend. Did I want to go back on the highway? They asked. Did I want to make some real money this time? The summer had been tough on me, they'd heard, and hardly any of the nobles back in town yet, so jobs must be scarce. And the nights were getting cold. They'd missed me up in Hartsholt. Truly, they had, though my style would be wasted up there. And now they were back in the city. How about it? I told them No. It didn't matter what they offered or how hard up I was. I wasn't doing that again. It leads to things I'd rather not think about. And it wasn't any fun.
Scott Lynch. Fantasy novelist Scott Lynch is best known for his Gentleman Bastard series, about a thief and con man in a dangerous fantasy world, which consists of The Lies of Locke Lamora, which was a finalist for both the World Fantasy Award and the British Fantasy Society Award, Red Seas Under Red Skies, and The Republic of Thieves. His most recent book is another Gentleman Bastard story, The Thorn of Emberlane. He maintains a website at scottylynch.us. He lives with his wife, writer Elizabeth Baer, in Massachusetts. Here, he takes us along on an insanely dangerous quest with a down-on-his-luck thief who has nothing left to lose, and who finds that by finding everything, he gains nothing, except for a rousing story to tell on a cold winter's night.
The Smoke of Gold is Glory, by Scott Lynch. Sail north from the Crescent Cities, 3 days and nights over the rolling Black Sea, and you will surely find the tip of the Ormskap, the fire-bleeding mountains that circle the roof of the world like a scar. There, in the shallows, where the steam rises in 1,000 curtains, you'll see a crumbling dock, and from that dock you can still walk into the scraps and tatters of a blown-apart town that was never laid straight from the start. It went up on those rocks, layer after layer, like 10 eyeless drunks scraping butter onto the same piece of bread. The southernmost Ormskap is still called the Dragon's Anvil. The town below the mountain was once called Hailfalkin. Not so long ago, it was an enchantment and a refuge and a prison, home to the most desperate thieves in all the breathing world. Not so long ago, they all cried out in their sleep for the mountain's treasure. One part in three of every gleaming thing that has ever been drawn or dredged or delved from the earth. That's what the scholars claimed. That's what the dragon carried there and brooded over. The last dragon that will ever speak to any of us. Now the town's empty. The wind howls through broken windows in roofless walls. If you licked the stones of the mountain for 1,000 days, you wouldn't taste enough precious metal to gild one letter in a monk's manuscript. Hailfalkin is dead, and the dragon is dead, and the treasure might as well have never existed. I ought to know. I'm the man who lost a bet, climbed the anvil, and helped break the whole damn thing. I tell this story once a year, on Galen's Eve, and no other. Some of you have heard it before. I take it kindly that you've come to hear it again. Like any storyteller, I'd lie about the color of my eyes to my own mother for half a cup of ale, Treggs. But you'll affirm to all the new faces that to this one tale I add no flourishes. I deepen no shadows and gentle no sorrows. I tell it as it was, one night each year, and on that night I take no coin for it. Heed me now. Gather in as you will. Jostle your neighbors. Spill your drinks. Laugh early at the bad jokes, and stare at me like clubbed sheep for all the good ones. And I shall care not, for I am armored by long experience. But this bowl of mine, if we are to part as friends, must catch no copper or silver, I swear it. Tonight, pay me in food, or drink, or simple attention. With that, let me commence to tell. First, how I fell in with the charming lunatics who ended my adventuring career. It was the year of the Bentwing Raven, and everything went sour for me right around the backside of autumn. 1 week I was in funds, the next I was conspicuously otherwise. I'm still not sure what happened. Bad luck, worse judgment, enemy action, sorcery? Hardly matters. When you're on the ground getting kicked in the face, one pair of boots looks very much like another. I have long been candid about the nature of my previous employment. Those of you who find this frank exchange of purely historical details in any way disturbing are, of course, welcome to say a word or two to Galen on my behalf, and I shall thank you, as I doubt an old thief can really collect such a thing as too many prayers. In those days, I would have laughed. Young thieves think luck and knee joints are meant to last forever. I started the summer by lifting 4 ivory soul lanterns from the Temple of the Cloud Gardens in Port Raugan. Spent a few weeks carving decent wooden replicas and painting them with a white cream wash first. I made the switch at night, walked out unnoticed, presented the genuine articles to my client, and set sail on the morning tide as a very rich man. I washed up in Hadrimsburg a few weeks later with a pounding headache and a haunting memory of money. No matter. I made the acquaintance of an uncreatively guarded warehouse and appropriated a crate of the finest Sulager steel padlocks. I sold the locks and their keys to a corner-cutting merchant's guild, then sold wax impressions of the keys to their bitter rivals for twice that sum. So much for Hadrimsburg. I cast off for the Crescent Cities. There, I guised myself as a gentleman of leisure, and wearing that mask, I investigated prospects and rumours, looking for easy marks. Alas, the easy marks must have migrated in a flock. I took the edge off my disappointment by indulging all the routine, questionable habits, and that's when the bad time crept up behind me. The gaming tables turned. Easy credit went extinct. All the people who owed me favours locked their doors, and all the people I needed to avoid were thick in the streets. Before I knew it, I was sleeping in a stable. I stretched a point of courtesy then and slipped an appeal to the local practitioners of my trade. My entreaty was coolly received. There was a sudden plague of honesty in the land, and schemes simply weren't hatching, or so they claimed. Nobody needed to arrange a kidnapping, or a vault infiltration, or have a barrow desecrated. This was a bind, and I confess that I partly deserved it. For all my hard-earned professional fame, I was still an outsider, and doubtless should have paid my respects to the thieves of the Crescent Cities a few weeks earlier. Now they were wise to me, and watchful for the sorts of jobs I might pull on my own. The wind was sharpening, my belly was flat, and my belt was running out of notches. I needed money. Yet honest employment was out of the question, too, as word of my presence spread. Who would make a caravan guard of Tarcaster Crail, bane of a dozen caravan runs? Who'd set Crail the cracksman to stand guard over a money changer's strongboxes? Awkward. I couldn't beg for so much as an afternoon hauling wash buckets behind a tavern. A larcenist of my calibre and experience? Any sensible local thief would assume it had to be a cover for some grand scheme, which they would have to interrupt. It's hard to be poor at the best of times, but in my old line of work, to be poor and famous, gods have mercy. I had no prospects, no friends. I could have won an empty pockets contest against anyone within 100 miles. All I had left was youth and a sense of pride that damn near glowed like banked coals. These were the circumstances that led me to seriously consider, for the first time in my life, the words of the Hellfolk in Wormsong. I can see some of you nodding, those of you without much hair left. You heard it too. Nobody repeats it these days, the fortunes of Hellfalkin having diminished so profoundly. But in my youth, there wasn't a child in any land who didn't know the Wormsong by heart. It was a message from the dragon itself, the last and greatest of them, the Shipbreaker, the Sky Tyrant, Glimraug. It went like this. High reachers, bright dreamers, bright enders, match riddlesong, venom, and stone. Carry ending and eyes up the anvil. Carry glorious gleanings back home. Isn't that a fine little thing? Friends, that's how a dragon says, why not climb up my impenetrable treasure mountain and let me kill you? From the first day Glimraug claimed the anvil, it took pains to welcome and entice us. Don't mistake that for a benevolent and universal hospitality, for of course Glimraug raided half the earth and spread dismay for centuries. No dragon ever deigned to smelt its own gold. But even as Glimraug fell on caravans and broke castles like eggs, it tolerated a small community of outcasts and lunatics in the shadow of its home. Once in a rare while, it would even seize someone and haul them to the crest of the anvil to make a show of its growing treasure, then set them free to sing the worm song louder than ever. Thousands of people accepted the dragon's invitation over the years. None of them lived. Some very canny customers in that crowd, too. Great heroes, names that still ring out. But none of them were ever quite a match for Riddlesong, Venom, and Stone. Still, for everyone who dreamed the impossible dream and cacked it hard, two more showed up. The dragon's anvil was the last roll of the dice for those who'd played their lives out and bet poorly. It was equally attractive to the brilliant, the mad, and the desperate. I was at least two of those three, and by that simple majority, the vote carried. I was on a ship that night, the Red Swan, and I scrubbed decks and greased ropes to pay for my passage to the end of the world. That's what Hellfalkin looked like when I finally saw it. Like the last human habitation thrown down by the last human hands at the far end of some mad priest's apocalypse. The sun was the colour of bled-out entrails edging the hulking mountain, and the bruised light showed me a gallimaufry of dark warrens, leaning houses, and crooked alleys down below. We sailed in through veils of warm breath from the mountain's underwater vents, and the air was perfumed with sulphur. Many of you must be thinking the same thing I was as I trod the creaking timbers of the Hellfalkin docks. How did such a place ever come to thrive? The answer lies at the intersection of greed and perversity. Here came the adventurers, the suicides, the mad ones intent on climbing the mountain and somehow stealing the treasure of 10,000 lifetimes. But were they eager to go all at once? Of course not. Some needed to lay their plans, or drink their brains out, or otherwise work themselves into fits of enthusiasm. Some waited days, or weeks, or months. Some never went at all, and clung to Hellfalkin forever, aging sourly in the shadows of failed ambition. After the adventurers came the provisioners of inebriation and games and rooms and warm companionship, and the town became a sputtering improvised machine for sifting the last scraps of currency from those who would surely never need them again. The captains of the few ships that made the Hellfalkin run had a cordial arrangement with the town. They would haul anyone there for the price of a few days' labor, and charge a small fortune in real valuables for passage back to the world. Any newcomer trapped in Hellfalcon would thus be forced to try the mountain, or toil for years to the great advantage of the town's masters if they ever wanted to escape. Mountebanks swarmed as I and a few other neophytes examined the town warily. The junkmongers outnumbered us 3-1.
"Don't breathe the dragon air without taking a draught of cleansing miracle water,"
shouted a bearded man, waving a stone pitcher of what was clearly urine and mud.
"Look around! The dragon air gives you clysters, morphew, wretched megrims, and the flux like a black molasses. Have the advantage when you challenge the anvil. Protect yourself at a fair price."
I did look around, and it seemed that none of the other natives were downing miracle mudbis to keep their lungs supple. So I judged none of us likely to perish of the megrims. I moved on, and was offered enchanted blades, enchanted boots, enchanted cheese, and enchanted handfuls of mountain rock, all for a fair price. How fortunate I felt to discover such simple generosity and potent magic in the meanest of all places. Even if I'd had money, I would have reciprocated this cordial selflessness by refusing to take advantage of it. Two gracious humanitarians of Hellfalcon then attempted to pick my pockets. The first I merely spurned with a scolding. The second mysteriously incurred a broken wrist and lost his own purse at the same time. For in those days, my fingers were considerably faster than the contents of my skull. I worried then about constables, or at least mob fellowship against outsiders. But I quickly realized that the only law in Hellfalcon was to win or stay out of the way. No more creeping fingers tried my pockets after that. Cheered by the acquisition of a few coins, I hunted for a place to spend them and tame my tyrant stomach. Ale dens of varying foulness offered themselves as I strolled, and street hawkers made pitches even less appetizing than the prospect of cleansing miracle water. Sooner rather than later, for while Hellfalcon was insisted with diversions, it was not terribly vast, its twisted streets naturally funneled me to the steps of the grandest structure in town, Underwing Hall. Here would be food, though the smell wafting out past the cold-eyed guards beside the doors promised nothing delicate. Outside, it was morning, but inside lay a perpetual smoky twilight. The entrance hall was decorated with bloody teeth and the slumped bodies of those who'd recently had them knocked out of their mouths. Porters, working with the bored air of long practice, were levering these unfortunates one by one out a side entrance. I saw more fisticuffs underway at several tables and balconies in the cavernous space. Given the relaxation of the door guards, I wondered what it took to rouse their interference. The servers, stout men and women all, wore ill-fashioned armor as they heaved platters about, and the kitchen windows were barred with iron. Rough hands thrust forth tankards and wine bottles like castle defenders dispensing projectiles through murder holes. Though I'd enjoyed some elevated company in my career, this crowd was still an intimately familiar sort, comprised of equal parts stupid, cruel, cunning, blasphemous, and greedy faces. Every corner of the known world had skimmed the scum of its scum to populate Hellfalcon. I resolved to step warily and attract no attention until I learned the order of things.
"Crail!"
bellowed someone from a balcony overhead. Ah, the feeling of receiving unsought the attention of a great room full of brawlers and carousers. Heads turned, conversations quieted, and even some of the servers halted to stare at me.
Tarkaster Crail?
Came a disbelieving shout.
Bullshit! Tarkaster Crail's a tall, handsome bastard,
muttered a woman. I was about to say something that would have, in all candour, improved nobody's situation, when I was seized from above and hauled into the air. The sheer power of my appropriator was startling, and I kicked helplessly as I was spun a disagreeable number of feet above the stones of the tavern floor. My assailant hung from a balcony rail by one arm and dandled me with the other. I prepared fresh, unhelpful commentary and reached for the knives in my belt. And then I saw the man's face. Your Highness, I whispered.
Don't give me the courtesies of cushion sitters unless you want to get dropped, Crail.
Still, there was warmth in his voice as he heaved me over the railing and set me on a stool as easily as anyone here might hang a tunic on a drying line. Here was a man with shoulders as broad as a boat's rowing bench and arms harder than the oars. He was dark of skin and darker of hair, with grey setting some claim to his temples and beard, and all the lines in his face had been carved by either the sea winds or the wild grin he wore when facing them. The other patrons of Underwing Hall rapidly lost interest in me, for I had been claimed for the table of none other than my old adventuring companion, Brangar Neverthroned, King on the Waves, Lord of the Azure. Like Helfalkin, the King on the Waves is little more than a story these days, though it's a good one, and an Azure Skald who'll sing it for you is worth the asking price. All the Azure clans had kings and queens, and keeps and lands and suchwise, but once a generation, their mystics would read the signs and proclaim a king on the waves. This lucky bitch or bastard would be gifted a stout ship to crew with sworn companions and set sail across the Azure realms, calling upon cousin monarchs, receiving full courtesy and hospitality. Then they'd usually be asked to undertake some messy piece of questing that would end in unguessable amounts of death and glory. Thus charged was a king on the waves, to hold no lands, but to slay monsters, retrieve lost treasures, lift curses, and so forth, until they and all their companions had met some horrible, beautiful fate on behalf of the Azure people. Brangar was the last so named, nor is there like to be another soon, for he and his companions were uncommonly good at the job, and left few messes for others to clean up. I had fallen in with them on two occasions and done some reaving, all for the best of causes, I assure you, though I am sworn to utter no details. Even my sleeping sense of honour sometimes rolls over in bed and kicks. Onward.
There's fortune in this. We had not thought to see an old friend here.
Brangar settled himself back on his own stool, over the half-eaten remains of some well-fatted animal I couldn't identify, sauced with sharp-smelling mustard and brown moonberry preserves.
What say you, Micah?
I gave a start, for sitting there in the darkness at the rear of the balcony was a shape I hadn't previously noticed. Yes, indeed. Here was Micah Kingshadow, rarely seen unless they chose the time and place. Micah, my better in all the crafts of larceny, who could pass for man or woman in 100 disguises, but in their own skin was simply Micah, good friend and terrible enemy. They leaned into the light, and it seemed the years had not touched that lean, angular face or the cool grey eyes that smiled, though the lips below them never so much as twitched.
Friend Crail has a hungry look, Lord.
They're in fashion hereabouts. Brangar waved casually to the remains of his morning fast-breaking, and I fell to with a grateful nod.
Have you been here long, Krail?
I'm fresh-landed as a fisherman's catch, I said, between bites of rich, greasy something. I did not scruple to avoid licking my fingers, for I knew the table manners of a king on the waves were shaped for the tossing deck of a longship. And I thank you for the sharing. This latest chapter in the book of my life has been writ mostly on the subject of empty bellies.
And empty pockets? Said Micah.
I have offended some power unknown to me. I took a bone and greedily sucked the marrow of some animal also unknown to me. An ill fate has swept me here to play a desperate hand.
No, said Brangar. And there was that damned grin I mentioned, a follow-me-over-the-cliff grin. A kind fate has joined friends to friends. Give us your skills. We mean to climb the dragon's anvil and crown our lives with the glory of a treasure claimed. The worm song bids us to carry Ending and Eyes, eh? Ending we carry in our steel. Eyes we still need. You are ever a fine and cunning lookout.
When do you intend to go?
Tonight.
I dropped my bone then, and wiped my mouth with a scuffed jacket cuff. I'm not best pleased to shine a light on my hesitation, friends, but I vowed to give every truth of this tale as much illumination as its due. I'd gone to Helfalkin in a desperate fever, yes, and by happy fate found two of the few people alive whom I might have chosen if given my pick of fellows. Still, with the weight of satisfying meat in my belly for the first time in recent memory, I found myself less than eager to set the hour of my doom so close.
I had thought to spend a few days preparing myself, I began, and learning whatever useful information might be.
You're no craven, rumbled Brandgar. Yet any man might feel the sting of fear when he sits in comfort and thinks of peril. Come, I know you would never run from a duty bound in honest wager. Lay a simple bet with me. Should I win, join us tonight. Else we wait 3 days, and you may seek whatever useful information you like before we climb.
Now here was a salve to all my several consciences, gentle listeners, by which I could keep faith with useful companions and still have time to ease myself into a frightful enterprise. I asked the means of the wager.
See the attic scorms that cling high upon the wall there?
Gazing across the wide tavern, squinting past smoke and flickering brazier light, I did indeed see a pair of the dark-scaled lizards motionless below the ceiling. Arm-length and even-tempered, attic scorms creep down from the mountains in all the northern countries and are either eaten as food or tolerated as rat-catchers.
The wager is this. Long have those two sat unmoving. Sooner or later, one of them will doubtless creep down in search of food. If the dark one on your side moves soonest, we go in 3 days. If the red-rippled one on my side moves, we go tonight. Is it sealed?
My oath, I said. And we sat at ease to watch this yawn-inducing spectacle unfold. This was not as odd as it might seem, for out upon the waves, the Azure will pass the time in friendly wagers on anything that catches the eye, from which way gulls will fly to which sailor on another ship will next use and empty a dung bucket over the side. I have eased fierce boredom with bets on some ludicrous trifles in my time. Not 5 heartbeats after I spoke, the red-rippled squirm on the king's side pulled in its legs. It didn't so much climb down as fall directly off the wall, like a grieving suicide in an old romantic tale. I sputtered without dignity, while Brangar and Micah laughed. Then there was a flash of silver light in the shadows, where the King's Choice had plunged. A thin mist rose into the air, a mist I recognized.
No,
I shouted.
That was no honest bet. That was a skin-shifting sorceress of low moral character who is
standing right behind you,
said Gudrun's Sky Daughter, appearing in silver light and mist. She ruffled my hair affectionately, for yes, I still had some in those days. Hers was 7 braided spills of copper, now lined with the colour of iron like her king's, and her round, flushed face was all mischief and mirth.
That was unworthy, I scowled.
That was fair as anything, said Brangar. For if your eyes had been working as a fine and cunning lookout should, you'd have seen that there was only one beast upon the wall until a moment before my proposal. Come, Grail, we need you, and you won't find better company if you wait here 100 years. This is fate!
I partly hated him for being right, and was partly thrilled that he was. A warrior king, a master thief, and a sorceress. Great gods, hope was a terrible and anxious thing. They were indeed allies who had as much chance on the dragon's anvil as any mortal born. I pondered my recent poverty and pondered the treasure.
I have never in my life behaved with any particular wisdom,
I said at last.
It would make little sense to start now.
Ha!
Brangar pounded the table, stood, and leaned out over the balcony. His voice boomed out, echoing from the rafters and startling the raucous commotion below into instant attention.
Hear me! Hight Brangar, son of Ortild and Erika, king on the waves! Tonight we go! Tonight we climb the dragon's anvil! We, the never-throned, the King Shadow, the Sky Daughter, and the famous Tarkaster Krail! We go to claim a treasure, so take this pittance. Drink to us, and wait for the word. Tonight we break a legend!
Brangar opened a purse and shook out a stream of silver into the crowds below, where drinkers cheered and convulsed and clutched at his largesse.
Gods, if I'd had even that much money just a week before, I'd never have left the Crescent Cities.
As the near riot for the coins subsided, a voice rose in ragged chant and was joined by more and steadier voices, until nearly everyone in Underwing Hall was gleefully serenading us, a single verse over and over again.
Die rich, dragon's dinner! Play well the game that has no winner! Climb the mountain, greedy sinner! Die rich, dragon's dinner!
The chant had the sound of a familiar ritual that had been much practiced. I liked it not a whit. Next, how we proved our resolve and broke a few hearts along the way. I dozed fitfully most of the day, in a hired chamber guarded by some of Gudrun's arcane mutterings. Terrified or not, I was still an experienced man of fortune, and knew to try to catch a bit of rest when it was on offer. At dusk, the moons rose red, like burnished shields hanging on the wall of the Brandywine sky. The mountain loomed, crowned with strange lights that never came from any celestial sphere, and it seemed I could hear the hiss and rumble of the stone as if it were a hungry thing. I shuddered and checked my gear for the 10th time. I had come light from the Crescent Cities, in simple field leathers, dark jacket and utility belts, I carried a sling and a sparse supply of grooved stones. My longest daggers were whetted, and I wore them openly as I headed for the northeastern side of town with my companions, pretending to swagger. Denizens of Helfalkin watched from every street, every rooftop, every window, some jeering, some singing, but most standing quietly or hoisting cups to the air, as one might toast a prisoner on the way to the gallows. Brangar wore a fitted coat of plate under a majestically ragged grey cloak with parti-coloured patchings from numerous cuts and burns over the years. He claimed it was as good as enchanted, and that he had sweated most of his considerable luck into it. Gudrun had never offered a professional opinion on this, so far as I knew. She was as scruffy as ever, a study in comfortable disrepute. Strange charms and wooden containers rattled on leather cords at her breast, and she bore a pair of rune-inscribed drums on her back. Micah were lightly dressed in silks and leather braces, moving with their familiar fluid grace, concealing their real thoughts behind their even more familiar mask of calculating bemusement with the world. They carried a few coils of sea spider silk and some climbing gear wrapped in muffling cloth. However detached they seemed, I knew they were fanatics about the selection and care of their tools, more painstaking than any other burglar I had ever worked with, and any professional jealousy I might have felt was rather drowned in comfort at their preparedness. The only real oddity was the extra weapon Brangar carried. His familiar spear, Coldthorn, had a bare and gleaming tip, and its shaft was worn with use. The other spear looked heavy and new, and its point was wrapped in layers of tightly bound leather like a practice weapon. When asked about this, Brangar smiled and said,
"Extra spear, extra thief. Aren't I growing cautious in my old age?"
At the northeast edge of Helfalkin lay our first ascent, an unassuming path of dusty dark stone that was marked by a parallel series of lines, half a foot deep, slashed across the walkway. Though time and weather had softened the edges of these lines, it was not hard to see them for what they were, the claw furrows of a dragon. An unequivocal message to anyone who wanted to step over them. I suddenly wished I could forget our mutual agreement to go up the anvil with clear heads and find something irresponsible to pour down my throat. One by one, we crossed the dragon's mark, your nervous narrator lastly and slowly. After that, we walked up in silence, save for the occasional rattle of gear or boot scuff on stone. As the odours of the town and the harbour steam faded below us, the indigo edges of evening settled overhead, and stars lit one by one like distant lanterns. It would be a clear night atop the mountain, and I wondered if we would be there to appreciate it. This first part of the climb was not hard, perhaps 3/4 of an hour, with the switchback path offering nothing more than agreeable exercise. As the light sank, the way roughened and narrowed, and when full dark came on, it ceased to be a path and became a proper climb, up a sloping black rock face of crags and broken columns. Rugged as it was, this was the only face of the anvil that could be approached at all. Brangar shook Coldthorn and muttered something to Gudrun, who muttered something in return. A moment later, the tip of Coldthorn flared with gentle but far-reaching light, and by that pale gleam, we made our way steadily up.
"What happened to everyone else?"
I asked on a whim during one of our brief pauses. When last I'd sojourned in the Never Thrones company, He'd had 8 of his original boon companions yet unslain, enough to crew his ship and drink up truly heroic quantities of something irresponsible whenever they paid call to a landed king or queen. Asmira? Loras? Valdis?
Asmira was pitched from the mast during a storm, said Brangor. Loras challenged a vineyard wight to a game of draughts and kept it occupied till dawn. It killed him in its fury, just before the first light of the sun slew it in turn. Valdis died in the battle against the Skull Priests at Whitefall.
What about Rondu Silverbeard?
The Silverbeard died in bed,
chuckled Gudrun. Under a bed, to be precise, added Micah. The defenders dropped it on us at the siege of Vendelsvana. I hope our friends know joy in the fields of swords and roses, I said, for that is where worthy Aja are meant to go when they die. And if it's true, I suppose it keeps all of our own heavens and hells a bit quieter. Though I hope I give no offence if I wish we had a few more of them with us tonight.
They died to bring us here, said Brangar. They died to teach us what we needed to know. They died to show us the way. And when our numbers dwindled and our duties grew lean, we three knew where we were called.
Gudrun and Micah nodded with that sage fatalism I had long lamented in my Aja friends. And though my presence on that mountain reinforced my assertion that I had never in my life behaved with any particular wisdom, neither was I boorish enough to voice my concerns with their philosophy. Perhaps they had always mistaken this tact for fellow feeling. No, I admit I could fight with abandon when cornered, but when I could see a meeting with death obviously scrawled in the ledger, I always preferred to break the appointment. How any of the Aja ever survived long enough to span the seas and populate their holdings remains a mystery of creation. We resumed our climb and soon heaved ourselves over the edge of a cleft promontory where a hemispherical stone ceiling, open to the night like a theatre, overhung a darkness that led into the depths of the mountain. The wind had risen, and the air was sharp against my skin. We gazed out for a moment at the lights of the town far below us, and the white-foamed blackness of the sea capped with mists, and the hair-thin line of sunset that still clung to the horizon. Then rose a scraping, shuffling noise behind us, and Brangar turned with Coldthorn held high. Red lights glowed in answer, throbbing like a pulse beat within the cavern. Whether they were lanterns or conjurations, I could not discern. But in their rising illumination, I saw an arched door wide enough to admit 3 wagons abreast. I wondered whether the dragon had left itself ample room in setting this passage, or if it could tolerate a tight squeeze. Unhelpful conjecture. In the space between us and the door stood 2 straight lines of pillars, and beside each pillar stood the shape of a man or woman. Brangar advanced, and the man shaped nearest us held up a hand.
Bide,
it whispered in a hoarse, sickbed voice.
None need enter.
Unless you propose to show us a more convenient door, said Brangar. This path is for us.
Time remains to turn.
There was enough light now to see that the horse speaker and all of its companions were unclothed, emaciated, and caked with filth. A paleness shone upon their breasts, where each on their left side bore a plate of something like dull nacre, sealed to the edges of the bloodless, surrounding flesh, by the pulsing segments of what seemed to be a milk-white centipede. The white segments passed into the body like stitches and emerged in a narrow, twitching tail at the back of the neck. From these extremities hung threads, gleaming silver, connecting each man or woman to a pillar. Atop those, in delicate brass recesses, pulsed fist-shaped lumps of flesh. I'd been near enough death to know a human heart by sight, and felt a tight horror in my own chest.
The master grudges you nothing. He may still turn and go home.
Our thanks to your master.
Grangar set his leather-wrapped spear down and spun Coldthorn, casting about a light like the sun's rays scattering from rippling water.
We are here on an errand of sacred avarice, and will not be halted.
Some enchanted guardians never know when to shut up, but this one had a reasonable sense of occasion. So it nodded and proceeded directly to hostilities. Each of the heart wraiths took up handfuls of dust, and in their clenched fists, this dust turned to swords. 8 of them closed on 4 of us, and with a merry twirl of my daggers, I joined most of my companions in making royal asses of ourselves. It was plain to Micah, Brangar, and me, as veterans of too many sorcerers' traps and devices to enumerate here, that the weakness of these creatures had to be the glittering threads that bound them to their heart pillars. Dodging their attacks, we wove a dance of easy competence, and with our weapons of choice, swung down nearly simultaneously for the threads of our targets. What it felt like, to me, was swinging for dandelion fuzz and hitting granite. I found myself on the ground with my right hand spasming in cold agony, and was barely able to seize my wits and roll aside before a blade struck sparks where my head had just been.
I had thought, muttered Brangar, shaking Coldthorn angrily, for either his rude health or some quality of the spear had let him keep it when Micah and I had been rendered one-handed. The obvious striking point.
So did we all, groaned Micah.
Speak for your cloddish selves,
shouted Gudrun, who had cast lines of emerald fire upon the stones, where they flashed and coiled like snakes in response to the movements of her hands, and were holding several of the heart wraiths at bay. I sidestepped a new assault, rebalanced my left-hand dagger, and judged the distance to the nearest pillar-top heart. If the threads had been a distraction, the weakness of the magic animating our foes surely had to lie there. I was not left-handed, but I threw well, and my blade was a gratifying blur that arrived dead on target, only to be smacked aside by one thrown with even greater deftness by Micah, aimed at the same spot.
Damnation, Krail! We're supposed to be better than this, said the King Shadow, as they whirled and weaved between onrushing heart wraiths.
If I live to tell this story in taverns, I shall amend this part to our advantage, I said, though you apprehend, my friends, that I have done otherwise, and will sleep soundly in my conscience tonight. Micah found a fresh dagger and made another cast, this time without my interference. The blade struck true at the visibly unprotected heart, and rebounded as though from an inch of steel. We all swore vicious oaths. Magic does, from time to time, so boil one's piss. Micah rolled one of the silk ropes off their shoulders, and with a series of cartwheels and flourishes, deployed it as a weapon, lashing and entangling the nearest heart wraiths, quick-stepping between them like the passage of a mad tailor's needle. I had no such recourse, and my right hand was still useless. I scrambled across the stones, swept up a dropped blade in my left hand once more, and whirled toward the two wraiths assailing me.
"Hold!" I cried. "Hold! I find I am not so eager for treasure as I was. Would your master yet give me leave to climb back down?"
"We are here to slay or dissuade, not to punish."
The heart wraith before me lowered its weapon.
"Living with yourself is your own affair. You may depart."
"I applaud the precision and dedication of your service," I said. And as the heart wraith began to turn from me, no doubt to join the fray against my companions, I buried my dagger in its skull with an overhand blow. The segments of the insectoid thing threaded into its abdomen shook, and something like creamy clotted bile poured from the mouth and ears of what had once been a man. It collapsed.
"That was a low trick,"
rasped the other heart wraith, and came for me. I wrenched my dagger free, which wafted a sickly vinegar odor into my face, and waved my hands again.
"Hold," said I. "It's true that I'm a gamesome and unscrupulous rogue, but I feared you were playing me false. Are you really prepared to let me go in good faith?"
"Despite your unworthy..."
I never learned the specifics of my unworthiness, as I took the opportunity to lunge and sink my dagger into its left eye. It toppled beside its fellow and vomited more disgusting yellow soup. I am the soul of pragmatism.
"Enough!"
I saw that only one heart wraith remained, and before my eyes the sword in its hand returned to dust. I had slain two. Gudrun had scorched two with her fire serpents, and Micah had at last bound their pair tightly enough to finish them with pierced skulls. Rangar had beaten one of his foes to a simple pulp, breaking its limbs and impaling it through the bony plate where its heart had once been. As for those hearts, I saw at a glance that those atop seven of the eight pillars had shriveled. Dark stains were running down the columns beneath them.
"You have proven your resolve,"
rasped the final heart wraith.
"The master bids you onward."
The eerie red lights of the cavern dimmed, and with the crack and rattle of great mechanisms, the arched doors fell open. Brangar advanced on the surviving heart wraith, spear held out before him, until it rested gently on the white plate set into the thing's chest.
"Onward we move," said Brangar. "But how came you to the service of the dragon?"
"I sought the treasure and failed 80 years past. You may yet join me when you fail. If enough of your flesh remains, the master may choose to knit watchworms into the cavern of your heart. So be advised to consider leaving as little flesh as possible."
"After tonight, your master Glimraug will have no need of us."
Smoothly and without preamble, Brangar drove his spear into the wraith's chest.
"Nor any need of you."
"Thank you,"
the wraith whispered as it fell.
"Did we amuse you in our stumblings, Sister Skydaughter?" said Micah, massaging their right hand. My own seemed to be recovering as well.
"Spear carriers and knife brains love to overthink a problem,"
laughed the sorceress.
"Feeds your illusionary sense of finesse. The truly stupid and the truly wise would have started with simply bashing at the damn things. But since you're somewhere in between, you tried to kill everything else in the room first. Good joke. This dragon knows how adventurers think.
She looked up at the mountain and sighed.
Tonight could be everyone's night to stumble, ere we're through.
Third, how I put my ass on the line, and how we sought the song beneath the song. Past the arch doors, we found ourselves in a vaulted hall, lit once more by pale scarlet fires that drifted in the air like puffs of smoke. For a moment, I thought we stood in an armory. Then I saw the jagged holes and torn plates in every piece displayed, tier on tier and rank on rank, nearly to the ceiling. Broken blades and shattered spears, shields torn like parchment sheets, mail shirts pierced and burnt and fouled with unknown substances. Here were the fates of all our predecessors, memorialized, obviously. The dragon's boast. Perhaps a part truth, responded Micah, when I said as much. Surely all dragons are braggarts after a fashion. But consider how this one seems determined to play fair with its challengers. The ascent up the mountain, with its gradual reduction of ease. The guardians at the door, willing to forgive and forget. Now this museum show for the faint-hearted. At every step, our host invites the insufficiently motivated to quit before they waste more of anyone's time. Proud to be numbered among the sufficiently motivated, no doubt, I followed my companions through the dragon's collection, uneasily noting its quality. Here were polished Sulugar steel breastplates and black Harazi swords of the 10,000 folds. Here were gem-studded pauldrons of ageless elven silver and gauntlets of sky iron that glowed faintly with sorcery. And all of these things had clearly been as useful as an underwater fart against the fates that had overtaken their wielders. At the far end of the hall lay another pair of great arched doors, and nested into one like a passage for pets was a door more suited to those of us not born as dragons. On this door lay a sigil that I knew too well, and I seized Brangar by his cloak before he could touch it.
That is the seal of Melodia Marus, the High Traprite of Sendaria, said I. And I've had several professional disagreements with her. Or, more precisely, the mechanisms she devises for the vaults and offices of her clients.
I know her work by reputation, said Micah. It seems Glimraug is one of those clients.
She's the reason I once spent 3 months unconscious in Chorister.
I twitch at the memory, friends, but not all of one's ventures can end in good fortune, as we have seen.
And 6 weeks in a donjon in Port Raugan.
And why I only have 8 toes.
Another fair warning, said Gudrun. A frightful spectacle for all comers, then a more specific omen for those professionally inclined to thievery.
We have 2 master burglars to test our way, said Brangar,
who seemed more cheerful with every danger and warning of greater danger.
And if this woman's creations were perfect, surely she'd have more than 2 of Crail's toes by now.
The craft of trap-finding is much sweat and tedium, with only the occasional thrill of accident or narrow escape, and we spent the next hour absorbed in its practice. All the stairs and corridors in that part of the dragon's domain were richly threaded with death. Some halls were sized to us, and some to the transit of larger things, and these networks of passages were neither wholly parallel nor entirely separate. This was no citadel made for any sensible court, but only a playing field for Glimraug's game, a stone simulacrum of what we would call a true fortress. Up we went, floor by floor, past apertures in the walls that spat razor-keen darts, over false floors that gave way to mangling engines, through cleverly weighted doors that sprang open with crushing force or sealed themselves behind us, barring retreat from some new devilment. In one particularly narrow hall, both Micah and I had a rare bout of all-consuming nincompoopery, and one of us tripped a plate that caused iron shutters to slam down before and behind us, sealing our quartet in a span of corridor little bigger than a rich merchant's water closet. An aperture on the right-hand wall began to spew a haze at us, the stinging sulphur reek of which was familiar to me from a job I'd once pulled in the mines of Belforia.
"Dragon's breath," said Brangar.
"More like the mountain's breath," I cried. And with a creditable leap, I braced myself like a bridge across the narrow space and jammed my own posterior firmly into the aperture. The thin cloud of foulness that had seeped into the hall made my eyes water, but was not yet enough to cause us real harm. Though once a few minutes passed, and I could no longer maintain such an acrobatic posture, my well-placed buttocks would no longer avail us. "It's what miners call the stink damp, and it will dispatch us with unsporting speed if I can't hold the seal, so please conjure an exit."
"Fairly done, Crail."
Brangar waved a hand before his face and coughed.
"To save us, you've matched breech to breeches."
"All men have cracks in their asses," said Gudrun, "but only the boldest puts his ass in a crack."
Henceforth, Crail the Cracksman will be celebrated as Crail the Corksman, said Micah. I said many unkind things then, and they continued making grotesque puns, which I shall not torture any living soul with, for apparently to ward off a stream of poisonous vapour with one's own ass is to summon a powerful muse of low comedy. Eventually, moving with what I considered an unseemly attitude of leisure, Micah tried and failed to find any mechanism they might manipulate. Then even the strength of Brangar's shoulder failed against the iron shutters, and our salvation fell to Gudrun, who broke a rune-edged bone across her knee and summoned what she called a spirit of rust.
"I had hoped to reserve it for some grander necessity," said she, "though I suppose this is a death eminently worth declining."
In a few moments, the spirit accomplished its task, and the sturdy iron shutters on either side were reduced to scatterings of flaked brown dust on the floor. I unbraced with shudders of relief in every part of my frame, and we hurried on our way, kicking up whorls of rust in our wake to mingle with the lethal haze of the broken trap. We moved warily at first, then with more confidence, for it seemed that we had at last cleared that span of the mountain in which Melodia Merus had expressed her creativity. I do hope that woman died in a terrible accident, or at least lost some toes. The red lights the dragon had graciously provided before were not to be found here, however, so we climbed through the darkness by the silver gleam of Gudrun's sorcery on our naked weapons. Eventually, we could find no more doors or stairs, and so with painful contortions and much use of Micah's ropes, we ventured up a rock chimney. I prayed for the duration of the ascent that we had discovered nothing so mundane as the dragon's privy shaft. Eventually, we emerged into a cold-aired cavern with a floor of smooth black tiles. Scarlet light kindled upon a far wall and formed letters in Kandric script, which I had learned to read as a boy and which the Aja had long adopted as their preference for matters of trade and accounting, spelling out the Helfalkin worm song.
As if we might have forgotten it, muttered Micah. At that instant, a burst of orange fire erupted from the rock chimney we had ascended and burned like a terrible flickering flower twice my height, sealing off our retreat. White-hot lines spilled forth from the ragged crest of this flame, like melted iron from a crucible, and this burning substance swiftly took the aspect of four vaguely human shapes, lean and graceful as dancers. Dance they did, whirling slowly at first, but with ever-increasing speed, and toward us they came, gradually, inexorably.
"Seek the song, beneath the song," rang a voice that touched my heart,
a voice that echoed softly around the chamber, a voice blended of every fine thing, neither man's nor woman's, but something preternaturally beautiful. To hear it once was to regret all the years of life one had spent not hearing it. Even now, merely telling of it, I can feel warmth at the corners of my eyes, and I am not ashamed. The four fire dancers glided and spun, singing with voices that started as mere entrancement and became more painfully beautiful with every verse.
The fall of dice in gambling den, the sporting bets of honest men, will bring them round again, again, to their fairest friend, distraction.
It was not the words that were beautiful, for as I recite them here, I see none of you crying or falling over.
But the voices, every hair on my neck stood as though a winter wind had caught me, and I felt the sorcery, sure as I could feel the stones beneath my feet. There was a compulsion weighing on us. The voices drew us on, all of us, cow-eyed, yearning to embrace the gorgeous burning shapes that called with such piercing loveliness. And that was the horror of it, friends. For I knew with some small part of my mind that if I touched one of those things, my skin would go like candle wax in a bonfire. Still, I couldn't help myself. None of us could. With every moment they sang, the pull of the fire dancers grew, and our resolve withered.
When beauties into mirrors gaze, nor look aside for all their days, until they lose all chance for praise, they wake too late from distraction.
I groaned and forced myself backwards, step by step, though it felt like hooks had been set in my heart, and it was 10 hells to pull against them. I saw Micah, reeling dizzily, seize Brandgar by the collar.
"Forgive me, Lord."
Micah cuffed their king hard, first across one cheek, then the other. Terrible fury flared for an instant beneath Brandgar's countenance. Then he seemed to remember himself. He clutched at his king shadow like a man being pulled away from a pier by a riptide.
"Gudrun!" yelled Brandgar. "Give us strength against this sorcery, or we're all about to consummate very painful love affairs."
Our sorceress, too, had steeled her will. She swung the strange drums from her back, gasping as though she'd just run a great distance, and began to beat a weak, hesitant counter-rhythm in the casual Aja style.
"Heart be stone and eyes be clear, Gudrun sees the puppeteer. Fire sings eights, Gudrun sevens, this spell your power leavens."
I felt the rhythm of Gudrun's drumming, like the hoofbeats of cavalry horses, rushing closer to bring aid. And for a moment, it seemed the terrible lure of the fire dancers was fading. Then they spun faster, and glowed fiercely white, and ribbons of smoke
curled from their feet as they pirouetted across the tiles. Their voices rose, more lovely than ever, and I choked back a sob, balanced on the edge of madness. Why wasn't I embracing them? What sort of damned fool wouldn't want to hurl himself into that fire? The fly with hateful flit and bite, the swordsman's feint that wins the fight, the thief enshrouded in the night, the world's true king is distraction. Micah knelt and punched the tiles hard, screaming as their knuckles turned red. I can't think, they cried. I can't think. What's the song beneath the sun? The lasting truths poets compose, the lowly tavern juggling shows, friends over card games come to blows. You're chained like dogs to distraction.
Fire! Bellowed Brangar, who was stumbling with the eerie movements of a sleepwalker toward his destined fire dancer, which was a scant few yards away. Fire is beneath the song. No, stone. Stone is below the dancers. No, the mountain. The mountain is below us all. Gudrun!
None of Brandgar's guesses loosened the coils of desire that crushed my chest and my loins and my mind. Gudrun shifted tempo again and beat desperately at her drums in the stave rhythm of former Aja Skaldry. Now to Six's singing, Aja Gudrun knows well, hellfire dancers contest can be met with no spell. Grimly laughs the king worm, mortal toys must burn soon. Fly now, spear of wave king, breaking stones before ruin. With that, Gudrun fixed herself like a slinger on a battlefield and pitched her rune-stitched drum straight at Brangar's head. Their impact, or the repeated shock of such treatment at the hands of his companions, brought him round to himself one final crucial time. The wall! Shouted Gudrun, falling to her knees. The song of distraction is the distraction! The song beneath the song is beneath the song on the wall! Heat stabbed the unprotected skin of my face like 1,000 darting needles. Smoke curled now from the sleeves and lapels of my jacket. I breathed the scent of my own burning as my fire dancer leaned in, looming above me at arm's reach. And I had never known anything more beautiful, and I had never ached for anything more powerfully. And I knew that I was dead. In the corner of my vision, I glimpsed Brangar steady on his feet. And with the most desperate rage I ever saw, he charged howling past his grasping fire dancer and drove the point of Coldthorn into the center of the Hellfalkin Wormsong that glowed upon the chamber wall. Rock and dust exploded past him, and revealed there beneath the fall of shattered stone were lines of words glowing coldly blue. Quickly, clumsily, but with true feeling, Brangar sang.
From the death here, all be turning. Still the song, forsake the burning. Chance at mountaintop, our earning. Though golden gain is distraction.
Instantly, the blazing heat roiling the air before my face vanished. The deadly whites and oranges of the fire dancers became the cool blue of the new song on the wall. An easement washed over me, as though I had plunged my whole body into a cold, clear river. I fell over, exhausted, groaning with pleasure and disbelief at being alive, and I was not alone. We all lay there,
gasping like idiots for some time, chests heaving like the near drowned, laughing and sobbing to ourselves as we came to terms with our memories of the Firesong seduction. The memory did not fade, and has not faded, and to be free of it will be both a wonder and a sorrow until the day I die.
Well sung, son of Erica and Ortild,
said one of the gentle fire dancers, in a voice nothing like that which had nearly conquered us with delight.
Well played, daughter of the sky. The gift you leave us is an honor. Your diminishment is an honor.
The blue shapes faded into thin air, leaving only the orange pillar of fire which still poured from the rock chimney. It seemed our host was done with offering chances to escape. Then I saw that Brangar was on his feet, staring motionless at a pair of objects, one held in each hand. The two halves of the broken spear, Coldthorn.
Oh, my king,
sighed Gudrun, wincing as she stood and retrieved her drums.
Forgive me.
Brangar stared down at his sundered weapon without answering for some time, then sighed.
There is nothing to forgive, sorceress. My guesses were all bad, and your answer was true.
Slowly, reverently, he set the two parts of Coldthorn on the floor.
29 years, and it has never failed me. I lay it here as a brother on a battlefield. I give it to the stories to come.
Then he hefted his second spear over his shoulder, though he still refused to unbind the leather from its point, and his old grin appeared like an actor taking a curtain call.
Bide no more. The night is not forever, and we must climb. With every step, I more desire conversation with the dragon. Come!
Fourth, how we pass from the brittle bones of the mountain to the snow of death. Shaken, but giddy, we wandered on into many pillared galleries, backlit by troughs and fountains of incandescent lava that flowed like sluggish water. The heat of it was such that to approach made us mindful of the burning we had only narrowly escaped, and by unspoken agreement we stayed well clear of the stuff. It made soft sounds as it ran, belching and bubbling in the main, but also an unnerving glassy crackling where it touched the edges of its containers, and there darkened to silvery black.
A strangeness, even for this place, said Gudrun,
brushing her fingers across one of the stone pillars.
There's a resting power here, not merely in the drawing up of the mountain's boiling blood, which is not wholly natural. There are forces bound and balanced in these pillars, as if they might be set loose by design.
A new trap? Said Brangar.
If so, it's meant to catch half the dragon's anvil when it goes, said Gudrun. Krail won't be shielding us from that with his bottom.
Is it a present danger to us? I asked.
Most likely, said Gudrun.
I welcome every new course at this feast, said Brangar. Come, we were meant to be climbing.
Up then via spiral staircases, wide enough for an Azure longship to slide down, assuming its sails were properly furled. Into more silent galleries we passed, with molten rock to light our way, until we emerged at last beneath a high ceiling set with shiny black panes of glass. Elsewhere, they might have been windows lighting a glorious temple
or a rich villa. But here, they were just a deadness in the stones. A cool breeze blew through this place, and Micah sniffed the air.
"We're close now," they said. "Perhaps not yet at the summit, but that's the scent of the outside."
This chamber was 50 yards long and half as wide, with a small door on the far side. Curiously enough, there was no obvious passage I could see suited for a dragon. Before the door stood a polished obsidian statue, just taller than Brangar. The man-like figure bore the head of an owl, with its eyes closed, and in place of folded wings, it had a fan of arms, 5 per side, jutting from its upper back. This is a common shape for a Barrowvarder, a tomb guardian the Aja like to carve on those intermittent occasions when they manage to retrieve enough of a dead hero for a burial ceremony. I was not surprised when the lids of its eyes slowly rose, and it regarded us with orbs like fractured rubies.
"Here have I stood since the coming of the Master," spoke the statue, "waiting to put you in your grave, then stand as its ornament, King on the Waves. The latter would be a courtesy, but the former will never happen," said Brangar, cheerfully setting his wrapped spear down. "Let us fight if we must, though I will lose my temper if you have another song to sing us."
"Black, my skin will turn all harm," said the statue. "Silver skin forfeits the charm."
"Verse is nearly as bad," growled Brangar.
He sprinted at the statue and hurled himself at its midsection in the manner of a wrestler. I sighed inwardly at this, but you have seen that Brangar